Ready to dive in? Welcome to Adventures in Truth Podcast. Every episode, we explore, expand, and evolve our understanding of the truths we encounter and experience in our human quest for clarity and exponential growth. And now welcome your hosts, Dr. Jeffrey Smith and Jim Case. Welcome to Adventures in Truth Podcast. And hello, everyone, and welcome to another awesome Adventures in Truth Podcast. Are you ready to dive in with us today? We're excited that you're here, and I'm here with my good friend and colleague, Dr. Jeffrey Smith. Hi, Jeff.
Greetings, Jim. How are you today?
I am well. After some vacations and some visits and some stuff and things, you know, life going on. It's been good stuff going on, and glad to be back and glad to be here with you and getting ready to dive into another interesting topic.
I'm really excited about that really fascinating topic that we're going to get to play with today.
All right. Well, just for a little behind the curtains thing, usually Jeff and I will spend a few minutes talking before we actually go live. And that's usually just kind of catching up. And then usually we try to throw out some ideas of either of us come upon a topic in our over the course of our lives since our last podcast. And then we toss it around for a minute. I think more than anything, we toss it around, and if it starts to get legs, we then stop talking and turn the machine on. So right. That's the place we reached now. And today is a topic that came up for me recently as I was contemplating some different thought processes and sort of reprogramming and I'd been kind of, you know, listening to some audio recordings of some seminars that I was interested in, and there's a sort of commonality in the languaging and in the experience that talks about things like reprogramming, things like how do you shift state, and how do you do these kind of things that don't always feel very natural, but once you get the swing of them, they kind of get easier and easier. And I was also kind of struck by the way in the languaging of the seminar and the stuff I was listening to, that it's this kind of, it's a kind of entrainment, but it's not a brainwashing thing. It's an entrainment thing. So it's like, and that got me thinking about, why do we need this? Why do we constantly need to kind of entrain ourselves in a different fashion? You know, this whole path of consciousness is largely driven off of that idea that we've got to take old belief systems and either discard them or find a new belief system that we can put our focus on to create new outcomes. And that's very programming kind of stuff to me and in my head. So as I was thinking about it, it struck me, we've talked in the past and I've read some things, and I know you've done a lot of research on the whole Anunnaki thing, which we can get into briefly, but largely that's about this race of giant people that were on the planet provided a ton of technology and ways that things could get done in the world, but that the population that populated the earth at that point were actually created by them to do the work. That's really what it was about. Whether it was called slaves or not, I don't know. Don't care. It's more the idea of this, you know. And please know, as a listeners or viewers, Jeff and I kind of land in different places on this because it's not something that I'm terribly dialed into. Just because it's not something that I'm sort of very much about. Make it work here. You know, we're on the planet. Deal with it. And not that Jeff isn't. I just, he tends to, he's had more exploration in that area than I have, and I'll let him speak to that shortly. But anyway, so I'm carrying forward with this. That led to thinking about the whole concept of artificial intelligence. And it led me to thinking in a really powerful way, what if that's what we are? What if we are the artificial intelligence experience?
You know, what if?
What if? And I kind of went, oh my gosh. And then as I sat in that and started connecting dots, it started freaking me out a little bit because, you know, when you think about the things that sort of the veil, as it were, that they had, that sort of the veil between the physical and the non-physical, or the veil between our dimension and some other dimension, all of these things are not readily available. Well, supposedly they're readily available if you can put your vibration and energy into the right state in order to access them. So how do you get there? Well, how do you get there is entrainment. How you get there is training this thing, this brain, training it to operate in a fashion that serves in a much greater capacity, kind of being run by the mind. And so we were looking up the definition for artificial intelligence, and it is the theory and development of computer systems able to perform tasks that normally require human intelligence, specifically human intelligence, such as visual perception, speech recognition, decision making, and they added translation between languages. And I think that's pretty interesting because all of those things are things that require some form of entrainment. They, you know, your visual perception is very unique unless you're trained how to look at things in a particular fashion or how to read or translate what you're looking at. So anyway, I don't want to co-opt all the front end here, so that's where we're starting at this idea of what if we are the artificial intelligence experiment, not sure where to go with it from there. So I'm going to hand it off to my buddy Jeff now.
Right on. Yeah, fascinating topic, Jim. I'm sure we'll get a lot of traction on this. So as you were talking, I was mindful that somewhere along in my journey, I picked up this little factoid that the most popular series on the History Channel is a show called Ancient Aliens, or the Ancient Astronaut Theory. And if you have not heard that before, you're thinking, well, you know, the History Channel's been around a long time. Mm-hmm. They've had a lot of shows on it. And I don't know what episode or what season they're in now, but I know that it's around 10 years or more that this has been going on, where people are really fascinated with any evidence that could be inferred that there have been other entities, beings, intelligent life forms on the planet, or not. And even, you know, some historical texts, I can never pronounce the Indian, is it the Bhagavad Gita? I can't, how do you say that? Do you know
Bhagavad how that's, Gita.
Okay.
Bhagavad book. Bhagavad. Now you got me, man.
So that's a really old book, 5,000 something years old or more. And even in the Holy Bible, I can't speak to the Quran or the Torah or some of the other sacred texts, but if we just go with those two, there are mention, as Jim talked about in his lead-in in the podcast, that there have been other intelligent beings or beings on the planet that were not the descendants of Adam and Eve, if you're going with that story. And it's just fascinating. So what are these? What were they? And, you know, all of us, not, I shouldn't say all of us, but many people and probably people listening to our podcast really do have an investment of where did we come from? Why are we here? And where are we going? And what are we supposed to be doing while we're here? You know, that's one of the things we love to play with and dig into each week. So AI is not something that we can just stick our heads in the sand and pretend that it's not happening. Mm-hmm. I would be bold enough to say that everybody listening to this podcast in some way at this point in human history has already been affected by it, in touch with it, involved with it. It's here.
Yes.
I don't recall if in a previous podcast we talked about right now, today, some of the major tankers, cargo ships, are traveling our high seas, going from China to the U.S., with not one human being on board these tankers. It's all being done with artificial intelligence via satellites. And that's just a profound concept that they can go that far, that all of the different possibilities of things that could go wrong, from bad weather to fog and all the things that could interfere, that they have redundant systems built into them, that they're autonomous enough to leave the harbor, navigate through a shipping lane all the way, you know, from to the other side of the world, and then get where they're going, dock themselves. And then what's even more fascinating, you got robots unloading the cargo containers. And some, at some point, the trucks will be automated that will deliver these big containers to the box stores. And at some point, little by little, there will not be human involvement in the delivery of goods and products that way. So that's already here. That's not next year. That's here now. Mm-hmm. In another conversation we had, if you just listen to the nightly news, there's already talk of autonomous cars. Yeah. They're talking about if you buy one of these cars and you want to let it work for you when you're at work, you simply take the steering wheel out so that somebody can't put it back into a piloted or driver status, and the thing will pick people up. Even Uber right now has Uber Deliver. So someone will put the box in the car will take it to where it's going to go, and someone will get it out. But, you know, these things, it's here right now. I personally don't have a refrigerator that has the technology I'm going to talk about next, but there are refrigerators that if you put a gallon of milk where the milk is supposed to go, it monitors by weight how much milk you have left. So when you're at the store, the AI in the refrigerator will send you a little message because it will know you're at the store. Because can you go anywhere these days where you don't get a little message on your phone after you've been there that says, did you enjoy yeah. this shopping trip you just had?
Artificial intelligence.
Exactly. So if little things like, hey, you know, you only have a half a gallon of milk left, and or it just populates it into your shopping list because your broccoli is 7 days old and it monitors when you put it in there. You know, so some of these things will be really helpful and kind of cool, but at what point does it become a nuisance? So this is not a topic that can be shelved or pushed to the side. It is here, and as a community, as a society, as parents, as people in relationships, we're going to have to make decisions on what is our relationship going to be with AI, how much do we want it in our lives, at what point would we even maybe find ourselves in competition with it. But back to Jim's point, that I giggle when I think about it, is, you know, what if really the joke is on us and all of this has already happened? Maybe what we're seeing right now with the Internet of Things and phones, like Jim pointed out, is our version of AI 2.0, but perhaps we are the AI version 1.0. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but it's a fascinating notion.
Yeah, there's so much. You know, they talk about the productivity piece. You talk about the emotionless piece. You know, that you're not dealing with the. I find it interesting too that the evolution of AI. So based on the premise of the question, are we the artificial intelligence creating artificial intelligence? What would that be about? But if you take that in context, and I know this is going like way out there, maybe not too much, but way out there. But if we look at the basis of much of the spiritual life, you know, we create our own reality. we're creating artificial intelligence, so that has to be part of our reality. So where is that coming from? Is that we are creating what we are? And through that self-reflection, through that, you know, it's sort of the microcosm, macrocosm. You know, when I was going through higher brain living training, one of the things that we talked about frequently with regard to this idea of stimulating the prefrontal cortex and activating, shifting state in order to activate this powerful part of the brain, is this idea that we're at a place now in evolution, in the human evolution, where it can actually look back on itself. You know, it's like we can look back and see evolution unfold from our perspective of the beginning. And so now, because of how the brain has evolved, because of how consciousness has evolved, and the idea that we are each these sparks of the creator, from God, of the whatever, of universal intelligence that are infused with this spirit or soul or life or whatever, that it's that we can now for the first time in history look back and see the evolution. And so it's evolution seeing itself happening. And in that regard, again, the thought that comes to mind is creating your own reality out of that. And so evolution becomes even more profound, because if you look at what's being created and you go, wait, how did we get here? Like, we're creating artificial intelligence. Well, in order to create it, we had to envision it. In order to envision, it had to come from somewhere. So there has to be something in our consciousness that seeks that, maybe, or is that's part of what that evolutionary draw is about. As you were talking too, I was thinking about what purpose would be served in a greater scheme of things if human doingness became obsolete because artificial intelligence handles the doingness. We would then have to be. We would have to live in an experience of being. I know, you know, many movies and a lot of speculation kind of throw this sort of negative cast on the idea of artificial intelligence, like us versus the machines and the machines eventually taking over and ruling the human experience. And I'm just kind of throwing out an alternative idea. What if we can create this artificial intelligence from artificial intelligence? What if we're able to, in becoming obsolete as doers, we shift into a different paradigm? And that means we become beers, which is what the message of pretty much every spiritual foundational practice is when you come down to it. It's the being instead of the doing. It's finding that space of that sacredness and that connection and of the divine, of who we are. That was the thing that struck me in the language too about some of the stuff, is that everything was focused on this, on coming back to love, coming to the center of love, being the experience of love, sharing the expression of love, and that if we go to that place, all things are possible and connection is automatic because we're connecting at a place that deeply connects us. And that has nothing to do with doing anything. It has to do with being willing to connect your energy to that aligned place of love and then connecting with people in that space. And that's a whole different experience in the world. And if we didn't have all that doingness going on, might make it easier. I don't know.
Let's camp there for a moment. think about somebody that has won the lottery, has grown up in a family with old school money or old money, a trust fund person, mm-hmm. A fabulously famous movie star at a fairly young age. Gangbangers, people that don't have structure because they don't have to do. They're at a place in their life in some way got there where other people do for them the menial tasks or the daily things, or just have a job. They don't have a job. People that do not have a job and have structure generally are not happy people. They are generally aimless. They're generally empty. And I know I'm stereotyping right now, and I hope it doesn't sound judgmental. I'm just trying to quickly go through observations that I've made in 25 years of counseling. You know, it's the classic mom that the kids are raised now, and it's called the empty nest syndrome. It's like, who am I? I don't have this job to do anymore of the domestic duties of home and raising the kids. You know, hubby's the same. You know, he nothing's changed for him. He's always gone off to work and come home. There just aren't as many people at home now and as many mouths to feed. So this having something to do neurochemically creates dopamine. When we complete a task, when we check a box, when we move item A from point A to point B, we get a little drip of dopamine on our pituitary gland, and that creates a sense that we enjoy. It creates a positive experience. We call it task completion or accomplishment. So if that goes away, we won't know how to replace that. And right now we can't make synthetic dopamine. We don't know how to do that. We know that cocaine stimulates it. In some ways, alcohol stimulates it. High risk activities stimulates the production of dopamine. And it's an essential between dopamine, oxytocin, and serotonin. It's in the big three.
But so doesn't connection also create a reaction with dopamine?
That's primarily oxytocin. That's what's produced in mother's milk at high quantities during breastfeeding. It shows up in huge quantities in stage four of lovemaking and the sexual response cycle. But dopamine is the adventure, the hunt, the thrill. It's the thrill and completion neurotransmitter. So I'm just wondering if the goal through AI is to eliminate repetitive tasks and to not have to dig holes. And again, you know, all the doing, we don't have good examples of human beings on the planet right now that have figured out how to be without doing. We just don't. It doesn't exist.
Yeah. Well, the whole thrust there is finding the balance between that.
Or perhaps as we're moving in that direction, more the newer generations, the next generations will show up with less of a need to have dopamine in their whole neurobiology.
Well, I think there is some of that already starting with this new generation of, and even the, where are we at now? We're at
Z, I think, is the newest one, isn't it?
So Jen, so say from, so you got the millennials, then Gen Y, is that it? I don't even know anymore. Well,
I've heard Gen Z referred to now also, but don't ask me to know when or where that starts or what that age range is.
Well, I think with some of the millennial, toward the end of the millennials into the Gen Y, Gen X, Gen Y, whatever those things are, it seems that there is some of that there already. There is already a resistance to the status quo. There's a resistance to this is how things are done. There's a resistance to this is the way things should be done. You go from here to here to here to here. And they're like, no, why? Well, that's stupid. It doesn't make sense. I don't want to. You know, the idea of work, huge deal. You know, you see it in the marketplace now. I mean, I deal with, Michael deals with it daily because he's in, you know, he's in a retail function. But the concept of work and what that means and how do it apply, don't care. If it isn't satisfying up some portion of their beingness, they're not interested. So if it's just a job to make money, that's not, some will do that and some can isolate that and say, oh, I need this because I want to get that. So that's okay. I'll work to get that. That seems to be okay. But the idea of a job that I'm going to show up to 8 hours a day, 40 hours plus a week for a paycheck doesn't sit well, it seems, with the younger generation. So I think there's a little bit of that flowing now. I was struck when you were talking about dopamine and What were the other two? Dopamine and
serotonin and oxytocin.
Oxytocin. I was going to say Oxycontin, and I'm like, no, that's not right. That's a drug. Oxytocin. it struck me again, just this weird little niggle. Like, really, how interesting is this? There are these chemicals that create a requirement in our system to be stimulated in a specific fashion. And they're required, they're not, you know, that when you don't have that particular stimulation, it causes havoc in the system, in the energy system, in the human being's ability to function well. How is that not artificial intelligence of some sort? That's the thought that I had. I'm like, my God, this is getting weirder and weirder. Now we have chemicals that are specific. So who the hell designed a chemical specific system that's designed specifically? But the interesting thing is that all of the things it's designed to stimulate are actually, to me, sound kind of more like expansive stuff if it's used properly. Like, you stimulate those energies and they can catapult you, if used properly, into altered states, into different levels of experience. Like, how could you manage those three things to catapult your consciousness in a way that you've never done before, knowing how they operate? You know, like you said, we don't have pill replacements for those things. So there's something that has to happen in the physiology and in the physical response that we have to engage that. So if you have to, there's that, God, that would be amazing to figure out how, not artificial, well, maybe even artificial stimulation. We're assuming that the amount that we receive from the minor things that we do is, I think, is all that we should really deal with. But what happens if you go with more? What happens if you find a way to stimulate those things to alter your state to such a degree that you're now, what are you going to see or experience as a result of that?
Sure. Well, let's dive a layer deeper on that idea. So going to work, the chemical doesn't know you're at work.
Right.
The chemical production doesn't happen because you walk into the door of your workplace.
And you punch the time clock. Yeah.
Around, right? So the chemical production starts because you have a conscious experience of, I'm working. I'm getting something done. It's this, again, the operating system of task completion that we're taught as little kids to make your bed, pick up your toys. You get a reward for it. And yay, you get a smiley face and gold stars on your homework and A's on your report card and all that sort of thing, and promotions and advancements. So, you know, it's a belief system that we have that when I'm doing something productive, I'm getting a dopamine drip. And so we're convincing ourselves, it's like we're creating it.
Yep.
We're doing it.
Jeff, let me challenge you here to let's take them one at a time because they have different impacts. So how might we engage that differently? How might we get that dopamine hit without going to work 8 hours a day, looking for tasks to feel satisfying?
Well, if there was a shift between what we would, our perception of work or our perception of production. Mm-hmm. So if you could somehow quantify meditation and you could meditate, I'm just using this as an example. If we could make a shift from seeing meditation as a way of creating serotonin, which is relaxation and kind of neutral, if we could see that as also production, then we might be able to get some dopamine created from something that was previously experienced as neutral or relaxation or play or recreation. Most people don't think of meditation actually is work. It's not easy to do,
right?
And that's why most people don't do it. But I think if you asked people, hey, what category does meditation fit in? Work, play, recreation, goofing off, whatever. I don't think very many people would stick it in the category of work, even though it actually could belong there.
Yep.
So it could be that through education, that we're helping people shift their concept of what an activity like meditation is, so that there would still be the balance of neurotransmitters until, like you're suggesting, there's beings, enough beings showing up on the planet that just don't need that drip any longer.
Well, I don't even know that it would be not needing the drip, just not being resisting the entrainment for how you get the drip. So that idea that the concept of work, as you were talking, it was extrapolating, and all of those mass conscious belief systems are all driven off this, literally off the idea of capitalism. They're all driven by money, because the end result is that, if you think about, there is not a place that I can remember in my history and growing up that the way that you do things, you go through school, you get your, you graduate college or high school with the best you can get, and then get into the best college and do this, because the end result is, what is your career going to be? What is this thing you're going to do that's going to stimulate the dopamine for the rest of your life? And it's all driven on the money thing, that you have to find the right work in order to create the right financial thing so that you can have the right things that you want. And that's all assuming that you couldn't have it if you didn't do it that way. I would beg to differ on that, not on that particular piece, but to this conversation, you know, I think I've lived my life, and in particular the last quite a lot of years, much more from the space of finding that stimulation, not in structured work environment, not in working for someone for this regimented amount of time, doing this regimented task. I mean, I am still driving and I like that, but there's really nothing driving that except me. You know, I mean, yeah, they have their rules of what the rules of engagement, so to speak. But past that, I am completely free to do and engage it however I feel fit and true, however I want to. There's no one over my head telling me how to do that, when to do that, you know? So that stimulation process becomes, even for me, even in the conversation, I can see how it's different. Because, you know, even talking to a client today, because I'm somewhere, I think I'm coming up on like 10,000 rides over the course of 3.5 years or so. And I love what I'm doing, but the idea somebody was asking me about it this morning when I was driving, and I said, yeah, I was at 10,000. I said, you know, it fascinates me, because just the idea that there are 12 or 13,000 people standing out in front of my car, and that all of those people have been in my car, it's freaking mind blowing. But even beyond that, the idea that I've served each one of those people in some fashion, either ultimately one, because I took them from point A to point B, which was something that was necessary for them, but then whatever might else have occurred in that experience, whether it was conversation or connection or not connecting or whatever, it's a whole experience. And so things that become satisfying are, you know, somebody mentioning the fact that the music is very relaxing, you know, because for me, that's a big deal, that when somebody gets in my car, that they get to be relaxed for the entire experience. And I'm carrying them to wherever it is they want to go in a space that allows for complete relaxation, you know, if that's what they choose. And you would be, I mean, maybe you wouldn't be, but I'm shocked by the number of people that impacts. Almost every day, at least one or two people talk about it with, you know, share that with me as they get out of my car. And that's huge to me, but that's a wholly different satisfying experience than I'm completing this task. So it's pretty fascinating stuff. So that was about dopamine. So
as you were talking about the shift that we're observing in the new generations being less materialistic and not having as much of a drive to work, it's rumored or theorized that if there was some kind of programming given to us as original men, as original humans on the planet. There was a program that created a fascination with the metal that we call gold, that most humans are attracted to it, have some kind of intrinsic knowledge that it has value, and would, if they could, store it and collect it, and are oriented toward gathering it and again, and considering it as having a value at some internal intrinsic level. So the idea, if you were going back to some of the original notions of the Anunnaki and some of our original programming, where maybe the idea of work came from, and humans doing the work, doing the labor tasks, the idea was for us to go find the gold that's here on the planet. We put it in bars, we put it in places like Fort Knox, and then it disappears. The current rumor, and I can't prove it, you can't disprove it, is that there is no gold and gold in Fort Knox, that it has been teleported out. And it's apparently highly useful for electronic circuit boards that might run spacecraft. That's the theory or the notion. And it's kind of really simplistic, but what other purpose really would we serve if we were an AI put here on this planet? We're kind of like all little individual miners, if you will, of seeking out that particular metal. And now there's some new ones coming along. There's cobalt that we're collecting, and there's some other interesting metals that we're here doing. But that could be where that program of work comes from. And then there's also just the natural, you got to go out and get food and create some shelter so that you can reproduce and your family continues on. So just, you know, kind of the procreation of the species, since we got kicked out of the garden and we can't just live off the land and go pick ripe fruits all the time, there is some new notion of working to survive. So are the X and Y and Z gens now that are interested in Bernie Sanders' message of entitlement and enough for everybody, and I'm probably butchering up his platform, but I'm just trying to use this notion or this mentality of, hey, why do we have to go to work to pay for school? Can't the government pay for that? Or can't they just make that free somehow, like wave a magic wand and somehow it's available to everybody? And we are experimenting with a universal income. There are, you know, that experiment is taking place right now, where you really don't have to do anything to get your credits or your chips to go exchange for food and clothing. So at some point, maybe there won't be a drive for the experiment or experience of dopamine and task completion.
Maybe, or
that was a really long.
Yeah, but maybe, and maybe it's again, you know, we don't know what we don't know. We know on a very limited scale what the dopamine produces, but I don't know if we've gone far enough to understand what its potential is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't imagine, you know, and again, because I don't ascribe necessarily to a negative viewpoint of the universe much at all, it's hard to imagine that it was the creation of even just that was about controlling. Do you know what I mean? That it was about managing people as much as it was about encouraging experience. Because if you take, it seems by virtue of what you've described, if you take any experience, the completion of any experience creates that response. So if you choose tasks that are not work related, you can still stimulate that because there's a beginning and there's an end. And when you finish, like going on a hike or making some connection to another human being or offering some, you know, I find this is true a lot too, that when someone responds positively to a piece of insight that I provide, is that a dopamine response? Is that where dopamine happens? where that communication of satisfaction stimulates in me a level of satisfaction. Is that a dopamine response? I'm asking you, Jeff.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. So there are lots of ways to get that experience. And it seems that the more that you focus on the experiences, the greater the, there's a tenet in Law of Attraction that talks about the better it gets, the better it gets. The idea being that once you have shifted state and you are connected and you are lined up and you're aligned with that higher part of yourself and you're going about your life that way, that there is this, you start at this level of experiencing satisfaction by just living your life and the things that you connect to, whether it's being able to at any moment stop and look around and see the beauty that surrounds you can create that experience. That when you literally take it in, when there is an emotional response to that experience. I don't want to get too far afield here. I'm trying to talk more of the idea that there's more there. We just don't know what the there is yet. So if it's okay, I think, I don't know that we can go much further with the dopamine, but I'd like to move on to serotonin and see if we can kind of play with that a little bit. So you want to share with us that whole science?
Yeah. Before we leave dopamine, it is created from eating protein. Protein is a primary nutrient or a building block or fundamental ingredient that the mind and body uses to create it. Serotonin comes from carbohydrates. And after you eat lunch, then you go to you're at a seminar and the speaker has that, what they call the death hour, when everybody in the audience has just eaten lunch. And a lot of, the American diet is high in carbohydrates, so people are sleepy and less interactive. So serotonin is the calming neurotransmitter, the at peace, tranquil experience that we seek, and you can manipulate it through your diet as well as activities that you choose.
Okay, so give some examples of where serotonin shows up in an obvious way, that the influx of serotonin. So, are you saying that the Thanksgiving coma is serotonin?
Yes. Well, that's some of that is L-tryptophan, which is an amino acid, but that's also one of the building blocks for serotonin as well. But as the Thanksgiving meal is also somewhat of a sedate experience. It's everybody sitting around. It's not dancing. It's telling stories, and it's a calm, generally kind of a calm, more tranquil, sedentary sort of experience. So you have both the energy of the experience and the actual chemical, because our mind works electrochemically. So it isn't all just driven by these neurotransmitters and hormones and enzymes, but these are things that just being aware of, if you know that eating bananas is going to make you calm and you don't want to be calm, then don't eat the bananas. But I don't think this is where you wanted to go in the discussion. I'll let you, you had the questions, so I'll take it back to what questions you had.
No, that was good. I was just looking, I'm looking at against this backdrop of artificial intelligence and this idea of all that we've been talking about, I'm wanting to flesh out the understanding more of the role the serotonin plays in our experience and how we would use that or focus it a little differently, or not. I don't know. I'm kind of letting myself be inspired as you're talking and as I'm listening and kind of looking for the dots.
Uh-huh. Well, one of the things that's interesting with regard to chemicals and our mind and everything is most all of the antidepressants focus on the neurotransmitter of serotonin in regard to its production as well as its distribution in the brain. And they're reuptake mechanisms that they block, and they last for about 36 hours, their half-life, before they dissolve. But they're largely a person's ability to enjoy what they're experiencing. And so depression obviously would be, hey, I'm not enjoying this anymore. So there's either the lack of production of serotonin or the distribution of it, because it can accumulate in certain parts of the neuron and not get absorbed and transmitted into the other parts. So there's an imbalance at times. Okay. So it's just, I find it interesting that that's primarily the neurotransmitter that most of the pharmaceutical companies focus on to try to help people feel better.
I'm going to pause us for a minute. Okay, we're back.
We were just talking a little bit about serotonin.
Can you reiterate a little bit of that last little bit there? You were saying something, it was important and I lost it because I got focused on the wire.
Well, all the pharmaceutical companies somehow have agreed, or the science behind helping people feel happy or a return to some level of joy, that serotonin is largely responsible for that. And it's either put in one of two categories, a lack of production of it or an imbalance with regard to the distribution of it within the neurons.
So are you talking about things like Xanax and Wellbutrin and things like that? Okay.
Actually, no to both of those.
So are actually inhibitors, right?
Well, Xanax is a short-acting benzodiazepine used to treat anxiety.
Okay.
Wellbutrin is an antidepressant, but it's an SNRI rather than an SSRI. It actually focuses on norepinephrine. So it's in the miscellaneous categories of antidepressants. It's been around a long time, and it's still used. But really, the SSRIs are the Prozacs, the Zolofts, you know, those traditional that everybody's heard about.
Those are about the serotonin?
Right.
Okay. So that's such an interesting, it sort of makes my head spin a little bit, because the when you think about, we're trying to create an artificial experience of feeling good because we can't figure out how to feel good without an artificial experience. And yet the very core of our nature is well-being. So huge disconnect between the origin and the destination in the sense that, again, this idea that how is it possible in a world of so many opportunities and so much potential and so much variety that we would not be able to find satisfying experiences or uplifting experiences or I'm kind of digging around in here
Are you talking like perpetually? Because I mean, we have plenty of enjoyable experiences to experience from the minor things.
Again, the idea of generating serotonin for so you have one. So the first one we talked about is a satisfying experience. Is task satisfaction, is I do things and I feel good when I do things.
Right.
Serotonin sounds like I'm trying to think of a similar phrase, like I am well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or I am not well. So the wellness aspect, wellness abounds. So where am I going with this? it feels really big. But so if we do it the same way we were doing with the dopamine, if you can create enough of it, the wellness then abounds. Wellness becomes the status. Wellness is a state you can achieve.
Right.
But like you said, the way it's created is that we understand it is through artificial sugar production.
Well, it's both nutritionally produced, manufactured, as a chemical, as well as the environment. So it could be both. Yeah. So every
talk event, about that a minute. I didn't catch the environment piece.
Yeah. So if you're jumping out of an airplane because you love to skydive, that's going to create norepinephrine, adrenaline, and dopamine. If I'm going to ride with you in your car and we're listening to calm music, I'm going to have a serotoninergic experience, not a dopaminergic experience.
Ooh, and you said those flawlessly. That was impressive.
So what's interesting to me is you can get there either way through biology, chemicals, food, or energy through the experience you're having in the environment that you're in, or a combination of both.
Yeah. So I was thinking earlier when you started talking about which one are we talking about now?
Serotonin right now. So, yep.
I was struck because I was thinking in terms of all of the thrust in the diets, in the dietary things that are about eliminating protein or about only having protein. That's actually probably more with the Atkins what's the other big one? The beach one.
South Beach,
and that stimulates some interest in me because I'm like, that's interesting. So dietarily, we're looking to only get the thing that provides that certain stimulation and eliminate all the other stuff because those diets all eliminate carbohydrates. So you can't create artificial sugars in the body. You're using meat to create, you said the meat was about dopamine?
Right.
Right.
So protein creates dopamine.
Creates this excess of dopamine or this continual flow of dopamine. And I've been there, done it. And I love how I feel when I do that kind of eating. You know, when you can go into that state of ketosis and you can maintain that ketosis for a period of time, it's a pretty awesome place to be, in my experience. There's a lot of really good feeling in that. I kind of lost the, I don't know if it's the ability or the interest to sustain it, just because it doesn't feel in balance either, but you can stay there for a long time and it sort of smooths things out.
My understanding of ketones is that's the brain using fat as a fuel.
Yeah.
And our brain, our dietary fat intake, we believe about 30% of it is used for brain function. So a fat-free diet, good luck with that.
Yeah. Well, and look at how much disease has been created as a result. When people, you know, over time, I think if we look over time, you would find that you don't really hear that so much anymore. You do hear it some, but not nearly as much as you did even in the 80s and 90s. Now it's shifted a great deal. But yeah, that's another interesting outcome. So, okay.
One of the things, so we can link our conversation with diet and brain chemicals back to AI is in the idea of a robot, an android, a synth, a synthetic human. That's what they're called now, as synths. And they do exist. If you want to Google this, listeners, there are places in Italy that you can interact sexually with a human synthetic doll. And from what the customers are saying that have had these experiences, they prefer it over human interaction, to the point that the country of Italy is in negotiation of whether they're going to ban them because they could see that they will have no population.
Oh, if wow.
They go in that direction, which people are saying that they would do that, and it's mostly men, who are engaging in, they're not even called a brothel because they're not real people.
Yeah, I've seen a couple programs actually on the TV about that level of that level of AI. It's pretty amazing.
So where I was going with that line of thinking is that these synthetic AI robot androids won't be using dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin. They don't need to eat proteins and carbohydrates and fats. So at what point are they able to actually have emotion, which would be, you know, fascinating. How does that work? How do you program, how do you electrically program, digitally program emotion and human interaction? You know, that's one level of discussion we might find ourselves going in. But the most compelling one to me is the idea of a spirit or a soul that we might call life. We might call that, consciousness. At what point does an AI achieve consciousness? And what is consciousness separate from energy? You know, because energy would be the electrical system, the biology, the chemistry. You know, consciousness is the awareness of something greater than you, the idea of I am, you know, I think, therefore I am, or like you said in the beginning, our ability to observe ourselves. That's really the fascinating part to me about at what point could AI achieve that level of awareness that it would be conscious.
Well, the definition of consciousness is a state of being awake and aware of one's surroundings, the awareness or perception of something by a person, or the fact of awareness by the mind of itself and the world. So that again creates an interesting conundrum, because all of that is creatable. I could see that, you know, state of being awake and aware of your surroundings. Turn it on. It now recognizes it's in a space. That's consciousness. The awareness or perception of something by a person. Her acute consciousness of Mike's presence. Well, the awareness or perception of something. Okay. So it engages with its human counterpart or whatever. It's going to have an experience, or it's going to have feedback happening in its system about whatever that may be, if it's been programmed, right? And the fact of awareness by the mind or of itself and the world. So it's saying consciousness emerges from the operations of the brain, which I think is actually not real.
Right.
That becomes a problem.
That's as best as they could understand it when they wrote that, for sure.
Yeah. Interesting.
So for a while, we may see intelligent creations that seem to be doing human tasks. I don't know at what point or even how love would be experienced. In some of the sci-fi shows that I've watched where they've got a nanny in the house that's an android, the kids are interacting with the android and developing attachment and affection and connection. And the android, of course, it's sci-fi, so they're trying to show that the android could have love back and affection back.
Did you ever see the movie called Mother?
Yes. Yeah.
Absolutely fascinating. But
yeah,
right up that line.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
If you've not seen it, the premise starts with an artificial intelligence, a robot that knows how to create life. And so a catastrophic event occurs, and these beings accumulated over time this huge pool of embryos, apparently because that was what they were focused on. But anyway, so this robot then births this thing artificially, has a baby, has a daughter, and then raises the daughter. And then of course the powerful part of the movie is then when an actual human being shows up and the struggle that ensues. But even at the end of that movie, was left you weren't left with the humans were in charge. But again, that whole idea of, you know, the child was brought up and raised by a robot and attached and had a relationship with this artificially created being that was very deep and very powerful for the child. So I thought that was kind of interesting. But one to definitely see, because it's an interesting concept.
So I'd like to apply some of our conversation today in a fantasy way that you and I and our listeners could play with for a moment. We've previously talked about how in the not too distant future, driverless cars will start seeing them. But imagine in the choice people may have as a Lyft consumer or an Uber consumer to be driven by a human driver or to be driven by a driverless car, because there's going to be a difference in the experience. One will simply be getting from point A to point B. Leave me alone. I don't want to have any interaction. I want to check my voicemail, my whatever, or just veg and not be bothered by having to say hello to the driver or make some level of connection. But then I'm imagining what people are experiencing with you. They're probably glad they had that experience that day. That's probably life enhancing rather than they just put up with you as you got them from one place to another.
Yeah. And there's some of those too, you know, but that's part of the role I play is the sensitivity to what is that experience they're seeking.
Right. So how would AI do that? How would AI be able to sense, do I leave this person alone? Do I engage them? Is there some reason that they're in my car with me today? Do I have a message for them? That would be fascinating if somebody's going to try to work that out and build that into AI. And just like my line of work, there are online protocols where there are people trying to create ways that you will be self-helped or you will be psychologically counseled without going to a human being's office. And I'm not talking about just doing it online, because that's been a thing for a while already. Mm-hmm. But I'm talking about the actual experience of working with a human being who can convey empathy and love and understanding and unconditional positive regard. And, you know, how does AI have that? What even is that? You know, that energetic soul spirit connection,
yeah,
that happens that people want. Some people want that. That's a really important aspect that, so I'm not having any concern in the next decade that human beings will be obsolete and there'll be no need for us and we'll all be on a universal income and just meditating and watching Netflix all day.
I guess that could be one way to go. I like that. But I was thinking, you know, with the artificial intelligence, you're right, that's going to be very interesting, because what we know how to do is program information in and information out. What we know how to do is if you're spoken to, respond. If you're not spoken to, don't respond. You know, but there's so much more to that, because it could be that simple. But it eliminates so many levels of experience between the human beings that's occurring. So we've done dopamine, we've done serotonin, and now we got to do oxytocin.
Okay.
That'll complete the three. We're
big three. Yeah.
Big three. So tell us about oxytocin.
Well, again, it's the very best studies that have been done on it show that large concentrations of it are produced in mother's milk. And although in this lifetime I haven't been a mother and I haven't had the experience of breastfeeding, my ex-wife was able to share with me her experiences. My girlfriend has shared with me hers. And of course, the myriad of women that I've counseled over the years all talk about this amazingly intense, sacred, precious connection that happens between mother and child that one might have thought was about eye contact and tactile connection between cheek and breast and just holding a baby and the hearts being close to each other. But really, and that's probably all part of it, it's just a spike in dopamine is what's creating that to the point that women would say they would prefer that over sexual intimacy. They would prefer
you said,
that.
You said that produces dopamine.
I'm sorry, oxytocin.
Oxytocin.
Oxytocin is the, for both mother and child.
Okay.
It's an intense union between both. And you could see why, because doggone it, that has to continue if that baby's going to grow, right? It's almost like nature, God, whoever wired that up, said, here's your reward for feeding your child. It's going to feel really good to you emotionally. Mm-hmm. And it's why typically Mother's Day is more celebrated than Father's Day. Mm-hmm. It just is, because we all had this amazing connection with mom. Mom held us more. There was more oxytocin experienced between us than there was with dad. Dad doesn't usually pick us up and start interacting with us till we're two or so. So the deck is stacked against male-male oxytocin creation as opposed to mom and child.
So where is it produced and how else is it produced?
So also large quantities in the fourth stage of the sexual response cycle. And in Hollywood, they used to, in the older movies, they would show after a couple has had sex or made love, they would lie in the bed next to each other and smoke a cigarette. Yeah, exactly. You got it. You knew where I was going before I even finished that. So I guess since smoking's not a popular thing any longer, I really don't know how Hollywood shows that today, or even if that's a celebrated part of the union of physical intimacy. But oftentimes, women will, you know, it's reported, there's been great studies done that's the driver for women to get to. They want the oxytocin, so they're willing to have sex, to have that coupling, bonding. And even if you don't cuddle afterwards, your brain still gets a spike of it. So even if it's a wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, and I'm done and walking out the door, there's still a sense of connection that's happening that generally makes people want to do that again.
So that is that. Oxytocin then shifts you into a state of what?
Connection.
Okay. So that's all about feeling connected.
Yep.
Okay. And so how does, so the males of the species only get that experience through sex?
Largely, yes.
Are there other activities that produce that?
Connecting activities.
Connecting. So what would that look like? Having a massage?
Sure. Going and hanging out with the guys and shooting pool. Okay. So anytime you're in a group setting, there's going to be trace elements or trace amounts of it produced. But what really makes us feel connected is when we're hugging for 10 seconds. So that's a really interesting thing. Yeah. If you hug somebody for 8 to 10 seconds, that's long enough for the brain to have a trace production of oxytocin. Mm-hmm. It's awkward because we don't practice that. 8 to 10 seconds is a long time to do a hug. Try that today.
I've done it many times. I know exactly what you're talking about.
That's what we would call a real hug.
Yeah.
As opposed to the 2-second embrace with the tap on the back.
Yeah. With the butt sticking out. Yeah.
Right.
So that's interesting, and that's even interesting as I was thinking about that, this idea of connection. We're not entrained to connection except through sex and childbirth, sex and kids. That's where we're trained to connect, and we do it in so many other ways, but a lot of times those coming together experiences, while they're positive, you know, ended up being somewhat clouded because you know, five or six buddies get together to play pool, and it becomes about two cases of beer later and 12 shots later. So yeah, the connection is still there, but the satisfaction of the connection, I don't know, is the satisfaction of the connection changed? Do you have any idea how substances it impact that at all?
Yeah, alcohol produces dopamine spike. So now you're mixing chemicals. You're doing dopamine and oxytocin. And that's a powerful cocktail for a lot of guys. That's what I'm creating when I go fishing with my buddies. We're out there on the boat for 24 hours and we're all bonding, interacting. And then we catch a fish and it's all exciting and something's going to die and there's going to be blood here and there. And dopamine's just going wild and we're all high-fiving and creating oxytocin. And
interesting. And then, so continue that analogy. So, because now there has to be serotonin in there somewhere.
And well, yeah, that is experienced after the dopamine is used up. And then we all have our crash and people go inside the boat and sleep while I sit up there and drive.
Or they eat.
Or they eat, sure, yeah.
Or they eat. Yeah. So again, we just created a very viable experience of how to stimulate the actual physical world way of how do I stimulate these powerful chemicals to create an outcome, to create to be conscious of that experience. So what that tells me is that if we become more conscious, each of us in our own right can then move forward in the creation of our own experience to create endless circumstances where you can engage that chemical response or shift state, as it were, because if you're engaging them consistently, it's going to change the state of your consciousness. It has to. It may be fleeting in the day-to-day when we're like, you know, banging around and going from this to that and the other thing. But if we're trying to live a connected experience, if we're trying to live a conscious experience, then those experiences should be consistent and laid into our life on a daily basis. So this goes to talking about daily practices. This goes to talking about the choices we make. It goes to all the memes you see about, get rid of the people that don't uplift you. Don't keep them in your life. If that, you know, all of that speaks to the same thing. It's about connection. It's about upliftment. It's about wellness. That when we make choices in that direction, the outcome can be profound. Because if you got all three of those things juicing at the same time, and you're riding that wave, and you're conscious of it, and then you're perpetuating it. It just speaks to everything that I've ever learned about consciousness and the expansion of consciousness. The better it gets, the better it gets. If you have that experience with your guys on the boat, our society, our mass conscious has trained us to believe that those are fleeting experiences, that those are limited experiences. So you have to do the grind and all the bullshit to live, and then you can take an occasional vacation to get connected instead of the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, again, this even this conversation to me sort of has a little bit of this self-discovery thing, this artificial intelligence learning more about that by virtue of this connection, we're stimulating all of the only thing that we're missing is serotonin right now. Where's my candy? No. And I don't know, maybe we're not. But interestingly enough that we can create that. And then I know for me, when I leave this experience, I always feel good.
Sure.
I always feel expanded and uplifted and connected. And I want to take that and I want to run with it, you know?
And we completed something. We finished another podcast. Yes, so that's back to the dopamine.
Yes.
And hopefully we're picking exciting, interesting topics, which again, it's not quite the same as jumping out of an airplane, but it's in that category.
Yeah, different. Because to me, it goes to stimulating versus satisfying. And to me, it seems like when those three elements are in balance and are regularly secreting or regularly, you know, dropping into the experience in the physical body, the chemistry changes, and suddenly you're now, you know, you're in this altered place that that we now want to strive to maintain. So how does that happen? Well, it happens by making conscious choices that are different than the ones we're currently making, if you're not able to create that on a daily basis. That's one of the things, I think we've talked about this before, but was always fascinating to me when I was doing my presentations for the work that I do. One of the things that I did would do in the presentation is we would talk about remembering a powerful positive experience that took place in your life, whether it was a wedding or a divorce or something, but that, you know, you turn to the person next to you and you share that experience and you talk about how you felt and what all the cool things were and why it was such an amazing day for you, and really get them engaged in that experience and remembering that. And then what I would do after the fact is we would talk about the qualities of that state. One of which is this feeling of invincibility. When you're in that zone, it's that sense of, I can do anything. I can experience anything. And that the other thing that was common was the next question, which was, how long ago was the event that you were just talking about? And for 75% of the people, it was 10 years or longer. For the other 25%, maybe 5% of those, it happened within the month of the conversation we were having. So figure close to 95% haven't had that experience that they consciously remember in years and or decades.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge telling point for people, because then they go, whoa, I've only felt this once in 50 years. What? and so it's just extraordinary that here we are perched at this precipice, I think, that if we have an understanding of leaving the basics of this, I think what's so profound about this conversation is we're talking about it from not just from a spiritual perspective, but what is the physiology? How does it work? When does it show up? What can we do to instigate or stimulate that? And how do we perpetuate it so that it sustains day in and day out? We're in the human experience. It's, you know, we're going to have waves of experience, but those waves don't have to be crash waves. They can be easy waves. That's all given on, if you're going 30 years without having some sort of peak experience, those are crashing waves you're living, because you have nothing to balance your experience. So I wouldn't mind talking about that for a little bit more if you have anything to add to that or any thoughts you had about it.
Well, where my mind went when you were sharing it was, we still don't know where those memories are actually held in our brain or what the mind is. I mean, we're still such novices at trying to understand any and all of that. But I like how you took it back to a mindful awareness of, it's been a long time since I've had that experience. I might want to recreate that again, update it.
Or how do I do that? How do I do that without a big event happening? And that's, I think, one of the things that's so critical is that it's not about the size of the event or the importance of the event. It's about making all of your events like that.
Yeah.
You know, where, and I can tell you, again, personal experience has been, you know, I alluded to earlier, I was on vacation and then I had some friends visiting, and the number of events that occurred on a daily basis when I would find myself just standing in awe of whatever was just occurring in front of me. And it didn't even matter. It wasn't just, I was on an Alaskan cruise and that was an extraordinary place to be, but it wasn't just about what you could see in the environment, what you could see in the pretty, you know, the pretty mountains and the water. And there were just these kind of never ending moments and connections and situations. Just briefly, we came back, our friend showed up, got here on Saturday, and I took them up to a place down the street here called the Red Rocks Amphitheater, which is an absolutely stunning venue for concerts. And it's an outdoor venue, but it's built into the Red Rocks. And it's, if you've seen it, you know what I'm talking about. I took them up to show them. And of course, like everyone that I've taken there, they're just blown away because you see all of Denver. And an unfolding of events occurred over the next 24 hours. My friend had said when we were up there, gosh, wouldn't it be cool to see a concert while we're here? And I said, well, it's summertime. There's concerts all the time, but I think much of them are kind of EDM music. They're more alternative bands and things like that. And I don't know if that's what you want to do, but you know, we could probably do that if you wanted to. And he was kind of like, yeah, well, we'll see. And so that later on that day, we were going to a barbecue at his sister's house. And the next thing you know, we find out that they're here from Saturday till Tuesday, and Monday night, Diana Ross happens to be playing at the Red Rock Amphitheater. We find this out on Sunday afternoon at 4:00. Not only did we secure tickets, we secured really inexpensive tickets in the middle of the amphitheater. All of us were kind of blown away, like, oh my God, this is really happening. And the next day, we kind of set a timeline. We were getting ready to leave the house, and Michael was, it was raining, and we were concerned because it's an outdoor venue. We didn't have ponchos, so we needed ponchos, and everybody was like, eh, don't worry about it. They probably have them there. We got to get to dinner because we're running late. So we go to dinner. We're having a great time. The waitress comes up with some food, and apropos of nothing, says, by the way, if you need ponchos, they sell them across the street. So I'm already at, Michael was concerned about it. It was something that was big in his mind, and we didn't have to fuss about it. It just showed up in our experience. That to me is these kind of connected experiences. This waitress just happens to share that they sell ponchos across the street. So we got ponchos, but it had stopped raining, so we didn't need them anymore. But the whole night continued in that fashion, where it was just one connected thing after another. We parked in a way that we parked downhill in a way that would enable us to leave quickly at the end, so we wouldn't be bogged in by all the traffic up at the top. Well, and where we parked, it just so happened there was a trail that cut through a large chunk of the road that we didn't have to walk. But when we got up to the top of that, it was pretty tiring because it's uphill, but it's absolutely beautiful. But as soon as we got to the top, as soon as we got to the back to the road again, there was a shuttle waiting for us when we got there. So we literally came off the path, walked onto the bus. You know, we're talking about a concert with thousands and thousands of people, and we were able to walk it. And it was 40 minutes before the concert, so it was crunch time. You know, well, we got to walk right onto the bus. The bus took us up to the top of the hill. We go get in line. Some random person steps out of line and says, "The line's shorter over there. If you have rows 1 through 50, go over there because it'll be easier." We're like, oh, well, let's go check it out. So we did. The line we were in was going nowhere. The line we got into was awesome because, one, it was moving. Secondly, it was the best views of the entire place that you could possibly get. And it dumped us right at the bottom of the amphitheater. So we're right there where we're going to sit. And so, you know, I mean, it sounds like lots of little stuff, but all those little things create such incredible amounts of satisfaction in me because I'm watching it unfold going, this is amazing.
Right.
This is freaking incredible. And all we're doing is showing up together. All we're doing is connecting. And out of all of that great energy, all of this cool shit happens. And if you're paying attention, you're getting all three of those suckers banging around in your head all the time because you're going, how does it get better than this? And then something happens and it gets better. You know, you go, wow, how does it get better than this? And something else. And again, it's just, you know, I mean, I get goosebumps thinking about it because we can absolutely consciously choose to engage those physiological things to help stimulate changes in our energetic field, which give us such a different perspective and such a powerful, satisfying experience that you don't wait 25 years to feel. You maybe wait 15 minutes to feel.
Right.
You know, that's a huge difference between 25 years and 15 minutes. So I don't want to go too far afield, but I think it's important to acknowledge the whole point of this conversation was to talk about this idea of being artificial intelligence, and are we the artificial intelligence? And even if we are, how are we programming ourselves? How are we, you know, our experiences are programming what we do and who we are. So why not use and create experiences that use the chemicals that create the feeling of expansion and bigness and health and wellness and all of that to catapult our experience into something that we've never had before?
Right.
I'm a walking, living, breathing example that it works. Now, am I there every minute of every day? No, but I don't think anybody can be. By virtue of the fact that we live in this complex, crazy environment, every now and again, you get shoved to the left or shoved to the right. But the cool thing is that when you're conscious of your experience, you know you just got shoved. So you go, time out, got to get back online again. Now I can go. Instead of being pushed offline and then wandering off into the desert somewhere for X number of days or weeks or months because we didn't realize we got knocked off track. You get conscious of that experience and you go, yeah, no, I don't want to go there. I want to stay on the track that takes me to feeling all of those feelings and experiencing all of those experiences. So I hope I brought that back around to topic.
Yes. Some of the sci-fi shows that I've been drawn to, and I've really been impressed with the writers challenging themselves. As one of the shows I'm watching, the androids have achieved consciousness. A small group of them have achieved consciousness. And the interactions that they're having with their owners, because, you know, their property, because it's just a machine, right? But once the owners realize that they've become sentient and conscious, the owners realize they need to have rights just like humans do. And they become advocates for developing their rights and wanting to free them and not have them be indentured servants or slaves.
That sounds very familiar.
So the thing that I find intriguing about all of this is the writers really, really struggling to define what sentience is and what consciousness is and how did that just happen? Which I guess I'm going to have to continue watching the series to...
What series are you watching?
It's called Humans. It's just... It's on Amazon Prime.
Okay.
But yeah, fascinating stuff. Again, we don't know. I've been at this for 25 years and been a pioneer in trying to understand consciousness and the mind, and we got pretty good at understanding bodily functions, but you know, we're so much more than that.
Yeah.
And we never, you know what, one of the things we didn't talk about in this particular episode is how would an AI ever get around to doing psychic work?
I'm not sure how that would work.
And can intuition be digitally programmed? Don't know. So,
well, you would think if you think of it in terms of brain capacity. What am I thinking? I was thinking in terms of thought. Not thought, brain act. No, I lost it. We'll come back to it another time. I was seeing two different things. It was the function of thought and the function of intuition. And I know they're totally different to me. The experience of it is totally different, but,
right.
But that also speaks to another topic, which we can dive into, which is that the brain is a transmitter, and that's only a transmitter. It's a transmitter and it's a receiver, and it doesn't do anything other than catch energy. It's just, there's constant energy moving around, and as that energy stimulates aspects of the brain responds based on this personality that has overlaid, you know, very much very sci-fi, you know, and translates these energies that are all around us into things that apply to us that have, and in the end really have nothing to do with us. And it's one of the challenges of consciousness of being human, is that we assume all of that trash has to do with us, and probably 90% of it has nothing to do with us. It's the brain doing its job transmitting. It's transmitting vibration, and it's receiving vibration, and then we're translating that vibration. And there's a lot going on there.
Yep.
We are, I believe, at that point in time in our conversation. Did you want to wrap this one, or you want me to?
I think we just kind of did. I'm feeling good about where we were and what we've talked about and the last little bit of a summary.
Sounds good to me. Well, it's been another amazing dive. I can't believe all the places we went in such a short time.
Well, when you're trying to put together AI and comparing it to humanity, you kind of have to talk about all the aspects of humanity to do some kind of due diligence to the topic itself, because we're not just talking about robots.
Right. And I greatly appreciate the depth of your understanding of the physiology and what a wonderful level that brings to the conversation, because we're not limiting ourselves to esoteric or pie in the sky kind of stuff. This is real life, real science, real spirituality stuff. And I think that's very powerful.
Right on.
Appreciate you for that, among other things.
Thank you for the topic and being tuned in to whatever you were tuning into to say, let's talk about AI today.
Over here.
Yeah.
Well, y'all out there, thank you so much for listening. We hope you found some value and some stimulation from maybe it got a little dopamine, serotonin, and oxytocin going for you. If this is your kind of stimulation. But it's great to have the conversation, and we welcome your feedback and interaction with us. And thank you for joining us on Adventures in Truth podcast, and have an amazing rest of your day.
See you later, everybody.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Adventures in Truth podcast. If you would like to listen to more or to explore all our offerings, visit us on the web at www.adventuresintruthpodcast.com. We also offer video versions of our podcast. Visit our page on YouTube at Adventures in Truth Podcast. We would love to hear from you. Like, connect, and follow with us on Facebook. Want to book us for your next podcast or to speak at your event? Head over to our webpage at www.adventuresintruthpodcast.com at the bottom of the page and send us a note. Thank you so much for listening. We look forward to seeing you again at Adventures in Truth Podcast.